In the depths of the Great Depression, while Cleveland battled hunger and hopelessness, something darker crept through the city's forgotten streets. Victims began turning up mutilated, heads missing, bodies dismembered with surgical precision, dumped in alleys and train yards. Police were baffled, the public was terrified, and even Elliot Ness, the legendary crime fighter who took down Al Capone, was drawn into a game he couldn't win. The killer was never caught, but nearly a century later, their shadow still haunts the city. This is the chilling true story of Cleveland's most gruesome mystery, of the nameless dead, a faceless butcher, and the failure of justice that echoes into our present. This is the Cleveland Torso Murders. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Great Depression's Shadow, Cleveland's Descent into Darkness. Cleveland, Ohio, 1934. Smoke hangs low over the Cuyahoga River like a warning not yet understood. Factories, once the pulsing heart of the Midwest, now cough out less steam and more silence. The Great Depression has carved deep scars into this city, and they show in the worn faces of steelworkers, in the shuttered shop windows, and in the growing camps of the displaced that swell along the train tracks of Kingsbury Run. The American dream has turned brittle, and in Cleveland, it is beginning to rot. This is a city on edge. The police force is overwhelmed. City Hall is embroiled in backroom deals. And in the alleys where light rarely visits, something far darker than poverty is beginning to stir. The conditions are perfect for a predator. Segway, industrial backdrop, distant train horns. Kingsbury Run was never meant for people. A shallow ravine cutting through the east side of Cleveland, it had once been a natural waterway. But by the 1930s, it was an industrial dumping ground. Waste runoff, rusted machinery, and broken dreams collected here. A place beneath the city, physically and socially. Shantytowns grew along its banks, made of driftwood and sheet metal, nailed together by men with nowhere else to go. These were the forgotten. Veterans, addicts, drifters, and the working poor cast aside by a system that no longer had room for them. By 1934, Kingsbury Run had become a city within a city, lawless, silent, invisible. And it was here, in this neglected corridor of human misery, that the first body appeared. But long before the discovery of dismembered corpses would paralyze Cleveland, the city had been unraveling quietly, its moral fabric worn thin by desperation. Flashback, 1929 to 1933, crisis montage. The crash of 1929 sends a tremor through Cleveland's booming industrial sector. Banks fail, steel mills cut shifts. Unemployment in Cuyahoga County reaches a staggering 50%. Families crowd into tenement apartments. Suicides spike, and still people keep coming. Migrants from rural Ohio, job seekers from West Virginia, African Americans fleeing the Jim Crow South. They bring hope in their pockets, but Cleveland has none left to give. The shelters are full. The lines for soup kitchens stretch around blocks. Into this fraying urban tapestry, crime begins to seep. Petty theft becomes routine. Organized crime metastasizes. In the vacuum of leadership, corruption flourishes, and with it, the city's vulnerability. Scene: Police Precinct, 1933. By 1933, the Cleveland Police Department is under intense scrutiny. Low morale, inadequate training, an inability to police the growing slums. Reports circulate of police brutality, of officers taking bribes from bootleggers and gambling rings. The city is rotting from the inside. One frustrated detective writes anonymously in the Cleveland Press, "We can't keep the dead from piling up faster than we can name them. The morgue is overwhelmed. Unclaimed bodies are buried in shallow plots on the city's edge." Then, in September of 1934, one of those bodies turns up, but not in a plot, not in a coffin. Instead, it surfaces from the waves of Lake Erie. And it has no head. Introduction to the first victim, the Lady of the Lake. On September 5, 1934, a man walking the lakeshore near Brattonall, an affluent suburb just east of downtown, notices something pale and fleshy tangled in the weeds. At first, he thinks it's a washed-up animal. But as he approaches, the unmistakable curve of a hip bone stops him cold. It is a torso, female, cleanly severed at the waist and thighs. The head and limbs are nowhere to be found. The police arrive quickly, but their investigation yields little. the skin of the torso has a strange, leathery texture, later revealed to be caused by a chemical preservative, possibly lime or a formaldehyde variant. The purpose? To delay decomposition. To buy time. This killer was methodical. The newspapers call her the Lady of the Lake. She is never identified. She becomes the city's first whisper of horror. But at the time, no one realizes it's just the beginning. Segue. The city looks away. Cleveland, distracted by poverty, doesn't pay much attention to the Lady of the Lake. She's written off as a fluke, a one-off horror in a city already overwhelmed by death. But killers thrive in such blindness. And somewhere in some forgotten room, someone is sharpening blades. Introducing the psychological landscape. The darkness of Kingsbury Run wasn't just physical. It was emotional, psychological. A place where social invisibility gave rise to literal disappearances. Where addicts vanished and no one asked why. Where a dead man in a boxcar might go unclaimed for months. In this place, a predator found anonymity. He learned the terrain, the schedules, the rhythms of the hobo camps. He learned how to disappear the bodies, and how to dismember without leaving a trace of blood at the scene. This was no opportunistic killer. This was someone rehearsing, and the Lady of the Lake was only Act One. Conclusion, building suspense. By 1935, Cleveland would come to know true fear. Children would be kept indoors. Headlines would scream in bold red font. And Elliot Ness, America's crime-fighting golden boy, would be dragged into a nightmare with no exit. But before that, the killer waited. In the dark, in Kingsbury Run, with a plan, and a knife. Because in cities where no one watches the forgotten, monsters don't have to hide. They just have to wait. Chapter 2, Lady of the Lake, the first unclaimed victim. It began with a body, or rather, what was left of one. On the morning of September 5, 1934, just beyond the eastern edge of Cleveland, in the quiet village of Bradenall, a man walking his dog along the Lake Erie shoreline came upon something tangled in the reeds. He thought it was driftwood at first. Then he saw skin, pale, wax-like, human. The torso was severed at the knees and lower ribs. The head was gone, the arms gone. There was no blood in the sand, no footprints, no sign of struggle. Just the body placed, not tossed. Police arrival, early shock, no panic yet. The Cleveland Police Department arrived with modest urgency. A single severed torso, even a woman's, was shocking, but not necessarily headline-breaking in a city still reeling from organized crime and economic collapse. Photographs were taken. Medical examiners noted the precision of the cuts, and more disturbingly, the texture of the skin. It had been chemically treated. At first, no one could determine whether it was an amateur's attempt at preservation, or a skilled hand trying to erase time, delay decomposition, and mask identity. The papers would later call her the Lady of the Lake. But in the police logs, she had no name, just a case number. Autopsy findings. A killer who knew the body. The coroner's report offered a terrifying hint of what lay ahead. The incisions were clean, even elegant. The torso had been washed. There were no defensive wounds, suggesting the victim was either unconscious or already dead before dismemberment. Even more chilling, her head and limbs had not been chewed away by animals or separated by decay. They had been surgically removed. The implication was clear. This wasn't the work of a madman in a frenzy. It was the work of someone who understood anatomy. The city shrugs, a case buried in silence. Despite the grotesque nature of the discovery, the Lady of the Lake failed to capture the city's full attention. The newspapers ran a few short columns. Editorials speculated about mob killings. Some whispered it was abortion-related or an underworld message to the police. But by October, the story faded beneath the weight of more immediate concerns. Labor strikes, prohibition-era gang activity, and a mayoral election clouded by scandal. And so the woman's case was quietly shelved. She was buried in a pauper's grave, without ceremony. Unidentified, unclaimed, her head was never found. The killer takes note. His city isn't watching. Somewhere in the city, someone read those brief headlines. Someone saw the public's indifference, the city's blind spot, and smiled. The killer had performed an experiment, a test, and it had worked. No panic, no dragnet, no detectives working round the clock. Just another nameless woman erased from the edges of society. Now, it was time to escalate. Flash forward. The connection to future murders. It wouldn't be until 2 years later, when a string of similar mutilations shocked the city, that investigators retroactively connected the Lady of the Lake to what would become known as the Cleveland Torso Murders. In 1936, Detective Peter Marillot and others revisited the original 1934 report and began to see the pattern. Dismemberment at precise joints, removal of the head, chemical preservation, unclaimed victims, disposal near water or in forgotten zones. The killer had been operating longer than anyone thought. He didn't start in 1935. He started with her, the one they didn't name. Theme: a killer who chose invisible people. The Lady of the Lake, like many of the victims to come, was likely homeless, transient, or a sex worker. Someone whose disappearance wouldn't prompt a massive search. And that was no coincidence. The killer didn't just pick victims at random. He chose victims the system had already discarded. In this way, his weapon was not just a blade. It was society's indifference. Chapter 3. The Kingsbury Slaughter, Dismemberment in the Shadows. Cleveland, Ohio. September 23, 1935. The air is thick with the grime of industry. Ash floats like snowflakes in Kingsbury Run, a ravine cutting across the city's east side like a wound no one wants to close. Two teenage boys, looking for scrap metal, step off a crumbling path and into a nightmare. At the base of a hill, half buried in weeds, they see something pale beneath the rusted frame of a discarded carriage. A headless body, then nearby a second, both naked, both male, both missing their heads and genitals, both drained of blood. The torso murders have begun, and Cleveland is about to lose its innocence. Scene: first police response, panic in the field. The police response is immediate, chaotic. Dozens of officers, reporters, and bystanders swarm the area. The scene is grim. The bodies show no signs of struggle, no blood nearby, indicating they were killed elsewhere, then transported to Kingsbury Run. The first victim is soon identified as Edward Andrassy, a 28-year-old white man with a criminal record. Arrests for drunkenness, bar fights, and solicitation. He was known in the area, sometimes described as a small-time hustler. The second body remains nameless. No head, no fingerprints, no leads. The media calls them the butchered men of Kingsbury. The public begins whispering a new name, the Mad Butcher. Anatomical precision, the killer's MO takes shape. The coroner's findings are both horrifying and telling. The victims were cleanly bisected at the lumbar vertebrae. Heads and genitals were surgically removed. Bodies showed no signs of clotting, meaning the blood had been drained before dismemberment. There were chemical burns on the skin, again, likely some form of preservative. These weren't clumsy mutilations. This was ritualistic. Cold. Practiced. The killer knew how to control the human body. Even in death. A medical professional? A butcher? A soldier with field surgery training? Police didn't know it yet, but a serial killer was methodically building a blueprint in blood. The system scrambles. Media heat builds. In the days that follow, Cleveland erupts with fear. Headlines scream across the front pages. Headless horror in Kingsbury. Police baffled as body count rises. Is a monster stalking our city? The public pressure is overwhelming. Detectives are pulled off other cases. City Hall demands action. The mayor calls for clean sweeps of hobo camps and slums. The Cleveland Press begins publishing daily updates, feeding a terrified public and fanning the flames. More bodies, escalation. Just months later, in January 1936, another headless corpse is discovered in a bushy lot near East 20th Street. The body is wrapped in butcher's paper. Nearby, in a makeshift crate, lies the victim's head, positioned almost respectfully, eyes open toward the sky. He is never identified. And barely 6 weeks later, in February, a fourth body turns up in a neatly wrapped basket behind Hart Manufacturing. Her name is Florence Palillo, a waitress, former sex worker, and known to many in the neighborhood. This time, the killer took his time. She had been cut into multiple pieces and stuffed into canvas bags. Again, the coroner notes clean dismemberment, drained blood, and chemical treatment. Now there are four victims, all found within a mile radius, all linked by brutal method and surgical precision. And the city begins to understand. This killer isn't just acting on impulse. He is evolving. The fear sets in, city under siege. By spring 1936, Cleveland is on high alert. Parents forbid children from playing in the streets. women walk in groups. Men who sleep rough in Kingsbury Run begin arming themselves with clubs and knives. Detectives are deployed 24 hours a day. A new task force is formed. Still, the bodies keep coming. And then, a break, or what the police think is one. A man is spotted dragging a suspicious-looking sack near the railroad tracks. He bolts when approached and vanishes into the dark. Inside the bag, the torso of an unidentified male, freshly severed, warm to the touch. But no suspect. No fingerprints. No prints on the bag. Just more evidence that the killer is taunting them, delivering bodies like messages. The killer's territory, why Kingsbury Run? Why Kingsbury Run? Because it was lawless. Because the victims were invisible. Because if you wanted to kill with precision and not be noticed, you went where no one cared who lived or died. The killer didn't just know the geography. He knew the sociology. In Kingsbury Run, a man could disappear. A woman could be butchered. And the city above wouldn't hear the screams, because there were none left to scream. Foreshadowing, the arrival of Elliot Ness. By midsummer of 1936, with bodies piling up and public confidence collapsing, Cleveland's leadership makes a bold move. They call in Elliot Ness, the man who crippled Al Capone, the face of incorruptible law, the golden boy of American justice. But not even Ness understands the darkness he's walking into. The butcher isn't running from justice. He's leading it, down into the alleys, into the shanties, into his world. And he's only just getting started. Chapter 4, Florence, Edward, and the Unnamed. Who were the victims? Before the headlines. Before the panic. Before the word torso became synonymous with death in Cleveland. There were people. Not just victims. People. Some had names. Histories. Others had nothing but the violence that claimed them. But all of them, every last one, deserved more than to be reduced to body parts cataloged in evidence boxes. This is their story. Focus 1, Edward Andersy, the city's first warning. Edward Andersy was 28 years old. He had a criminal record. Public intoxication. Assault. He drifted in and out of downtown bars and gambling dens. By official accounts, he was a troubled man, a drinker, a fighter, a regular in Cleveland's underworld. But behind that reputation was a man clinging to dignity in a world that offered little. He lived with his mother, worked odd jobs, tried, in his own way, to survive the Depression. On September 23, 1935, Edward's headless body was found in Kingsbury Run. His genitals had been removed, a clear act of intentional degradation. His head was located nearby, wrapped in dirty clothing, placed in a fashion that almost mimicked a burial. Some speculated it was a message. Others thought it was ritual. But to his mother, it was something else entirely. A cruelty so vast it defied mourning. She never recovered. She would sit at her window every night for years, staring into the dark, as if waiting for him to walk home. Focus 2, Florence Polillo, a woman erased twice. Florence Genevieve Polillo was once a waitress. Once a wife. Once loved. By 1936, she was scraping by, renting a small room, selling her body for money or protection, depending on the day. Her neighbors remembered her as kind, warm, always willing to share what little she had. Her body was discovered in February 1936, packed into canvas baskets, sliced into sections that suggested both anatomical knowledge and emotional detachment. Her head was missing. So were her arms. The autopsy showed no hesitation marks, no jagged cuts. Florence had been methodically disassembled. And yet the killer had washed her, a strange, almost intimate final act. Not for dignity, perhaps, but for control. When reporters tried to track down her family, none could be found. Florence's story wasn't just a murder. It was a life of erasure, made permanent by the butcher's blade. Focus 3, the unknown victims, the system's silence. For every Edward and Florence, there were others. Men and women who remain unidentified to this day. Some were given nicknames by the press. The tattooed man, his arms covered in strange ink, possibly a merchant sailor, possibly a carnival worker. Found with his head and heart missing. Never claimed. Victim number 5. Partial remains discovered in a burlap sack by a homeless man scavenging for rags. The only identifying feature, a silver tooth. No match was ever found. The boy, a suspected teenager, no facial hair, delicate bone structure. His torso turned up along the river. Some speculate he was a runaway. Others think he was a mistake. the killer didn't realize how young he was until it was too late. Cleveland authorities filed these bodies under codes. Doe 1936-3A, unidentified male, white female, age unknown. They became case files, not people. Their stories lived only in scars. In scars no one could trace. Theme: poverty as a predator's best ally. These victims weren't chosen at random. They were strategically selected, drawn from the ranks of the displaced, the voiceless, the ones who wouldn't be missed until their bodies became impossible to ignore. In a twisted way, the killer understood something that law enforcement failed to grasp for years. If you choose your victims from the forgotten, you can kill indefinitely. Cleveland in the 1930s had created the perfect hunting ground. Dense poverty, institutional neglect, and a law enforcement system more concerned with protecting property than people. Insight: the victims were not weak, just unseen. It's easy to look back at these victims and see only tragedy, but these were people who fought daily battles, who resisted despair with scraps of hope, who kept moving, even when the world pushed them down. Florence gave food to neighbors she could barely feed herself. Edward helped fix radios on weekends for change. The tattooed man, some believe he may have been a war veteran. They were not weak. They were not throwaways. They were human, and their only true failure was to live in a world that didn't see them until they were already dead. Chapter 5: The Elliott Ness Gamble, Fire, Fear, and Political Games. By the summer of 1936, Cleveland was in crisis. The torso killer had claimed at least 6 lives. Most of them found hacked apart, heads missing, blood drained, torsos dumped across Kingsbury Run like refuse. The police were overworked. The public was terrified, and the killer was getting bolder. The newspapers demanded action. The mayor demanded results. And into the chaos stepped a name already etched in American legend: Elliott Ness, the man who brought down Al Capone, the symbol of justice. But in Cleveland, Elliott Ness would not be remembered as a hero. He would become a man chasing shadows and lighting matches in the dark. Flashback: Elliott Ness arrives in Cleveland. Elliott Ness had been appointed Cleveland's safety director in December 1935, a position that gave him authority over both the police and fire departments. He was young, well-dressed, media-savvy, and known for his incorruptibility. The city hoped his presence would restore order and reform a system crumbling from the inside. But Ness had never faced anything like this. Bootleggers and mobsters operated in plain sight. The torso killer did not. Kingsbury Run, the heart of the hunt. Ness quickly identified Kingsbury Run as ground zero for the murders. It was where most of the bodies were discovered. It was also home to Cleveland's largest shantytown, an unsanctioned village of the jobless, the homeless, the forgotten. Hundreds lived there in makeshift homes constructed from driftwood, tarpaulin, and rusted car frames. They cooked over open fires, slept beneath leaking tin, watched over each other like family, because the rest of the city never did. But to Ness, this community had become the killer's hunting ground. And Ness was about to make a decision that would define his legacy forever. A city on fire, Ness's sweep. In the early morning hours of August 18, 1938, just weeks after 2 new decapitated bodies were discovered beneath a bridge near Ness's own office, the safety director made his move. Under cover of darkness, flanked by police and firefighters, Ness descended into Kingsbury Run with a warrantless raid. The goal: to clean out the ravine. What followed was one of the most controversial actions in Cleveland law enforcement history. Hundreds were dragged from their beds. Some were interrogated. Some simply vanished. And when the sun rose, Ness gave the order: burn it all. Scene: flames rising, voices screaming. The flames lit up the ravine like a funeral pyre. Homes turned to ash. Blankets, photographs, medicine bottles. Gone. No warning. No relocation plan. No accountability. The residents of Kingsbury Run, already among the most marginalized people in America, were scattered across the city like smoke. Elliott Ness told the press it was a tactical strike designed to deny the killer access to his favorite hunting ground. But what it really did was erase a community. A community that had long lived in the blind spot of Cleveland's conscience. Public backlash, the beginning of doubt. At first, the public applauded. The headlines praised Ness's bold stand and decisive action. Some believed the raid might flush the killer out. Others called it justice, delivered by fire. But weeks passed, and the murders didn't stop. and no suspect emerged from the ashes. Soon, the media began to shift tone. Editorials questioned the legality of Ness's raid. Civil groups demanded answers. Homeless advocates condemned the destruction. Was it a strategic move or a political stunt? And behind closed doors, even within the police department, officers began to whisper. Had Elliot Ness lost control? The killer responds, a message delivered. If Ness thought the fire would rattle the killer, he was wrong. Just 1 month later, in September 1938, a torso washed up on the shore of Lake Erie, its arms bound, head missing. A day later, another was discovered near a railroad yard, both within the jurisdiction of Elliot Ness, both left in plain sight, as if to say, "You can burn my playground, but you will never find me." Ness's silence, a hero unraveling. As pressure mounted, Ness withdrew from the public eye. He refused to speak at press conferences. He avoided reporters. His once celebrated name began to rot in the headlines. Some say the torso killer broke him. Others believe he knew who the killer was and couldn't prove it. But whatever the truth, one thing was clear. The fire didn't stop the killer. It only stained Elliot Ness's legacy. Forever. Theme: fear doesn't build justice, it burns it. The story of Kingsbury Run is not just about crime. It's about fear. Fear that led a man once revered for justice to turn a torch on the very people he was meant to protect. Elliot Ness came to Cleveland to clean up corruption. He left it with blood on his hands, and a case that would haunt him until the day he died. Chapter 6, Dr. Francis Sweeney, Genius or Butcher. Of all the names whispered in the long shadow of the Cleveland torso murders, one name, one man, stands above the rest. A surgeon, a war veteran, a man with steady hands, and a mind that may have fractured somewhere between the trenches of Europe and the alleyways of Cleveland. His name was Dr. Francis E. Sweeney, and for Elliot Ness, he was the closest thing to a face behind the blade. But if Sweeney was the killer, then justice never came. And if he wasn't, then the real butcher was never even questioned. This is the story of the man who may have haunted Kingsbury Run, with a scalpel in one hand and a secret in the other. Who was Dr. Francis Sweeney? Francis Edward Sweeney was born in 1894. He came from a prominent Irish-American family in Cleveland, well-educated, respected. A promising student, he graduated from St. Ignatius High School, studied medicine, and eventually earned a degree from St. Louis University Medical School. He became a surgeon, just in time to serve as a field medic in World War I. It was there, among the carnage of the Western Front, that Sweeney reportedly gained extensive experience in performing emergency amputations under pressure, often without anesthesia, often in the mud and horror of battle. By the time he returned to Cleveland, Sweeney was skilled, decorated, and deeply troubled. He drank heavily. He lost his practice. And he began showing signs of severe paranoia and instability. His career unraveled quietly. His wife left, but he remained connected to powerful figures in the city, including a U.S. congressman cousin who would later complicate matters for law enforcement. To the public, he was a fallen doctor. To Ness, he became suspect number one. The secret interrogations, polygraph tests. In the summer of 1938, after two more dismembered victims were discovered within sight of Elliot Ness's office, the safety director took an unusual step. He brought in Dr. Francis Sweeney privately. No arrest. No press. Sweeney was taken to a hotel room, where he was subjected to one of the earliest forms of the polygraph test, administered by Leonard Keeler, a pioneer of lie detection and the inventor of the device. The results? Sweeney failed. Spectacularly. Keeler would later say Sweeney showed signs of deception, deflection, and an eerily flat effect throughout the sessions. But Ness had a problem. There was no physical evidence, no eyewitnesses. And Sweeney's cousin, a sitting U.S. congressman, was already applying quiet political pressure. An arrest would be career suicide without hard proof. So Ness made a fateful decision. He let Sweeney go, and never told the public. A life in the shadows, the postcards begin. Within weeks, Elliot Ness began receiving postcards. They were handwritten, mocking, obsessive. They arrived at his home, his office. Sometimes unsigned, sometimes bearing inside references only someone close to the case could possibly know. Ness never publicly confirmed the author, but many believe it was Sweeney, taunting the man who had suspected him, but failed to act. The cards continued for nearly two decades. The killer, it seemed, was still watching, still whispering, still in control. Why Ness never acted publicly. Ness, now under political pressure and public scrutiny after the controversial burning of Kingsbury Run, knew he had no case. The polygraph was not admissible in court. There were no fingerprints. And Sweeney, once institutionalized, could not be compelled to testify. It was a stalemate. Privately, Ness told friends he believed Sweeney was the killer. But publicly, he stayed silent. For the rest of his life, Dr. Sweeney's final years, after his polygraph interrogations, Sweeney voluntarily committed himself to a veterans hospital for the mentally ill in Dayton, Ohio. He remained there, in and out of care, until his death in 1964. He was never charged, never convicted, never confronted. But when he died, Elliot Ness had been gone 7 years. His health broken, his reputation diminished, and his silence on the Torso murders forever unbroken. Two lives, two fates, tied by blood neither could wash away. Theme, genius and madness forever entwined. Was Dr. Francis Sweeney a killer? A man with the medical precision, psychological profile, and access to bodies, who slipped into the void between respectability and rage? Or was he a scapegoat, convenient, broken, and politically untouchable? We may never know. But the truth is this. The moment Elliot Ness let Francis Sweeney walk free, the case was over, and the mystery was born. Chapter 7. The Confessions That Didn't Stick. By late 1938, the Cleveland Police Department was desperate. The public wanted justice. The newspapers demanded names. And Elliot Ness, once untouchable, now stood on a crumbling pedestal of doubt. But the killer remained at large. So the city did what so many institutions do when truth proves elusive. It forced a confession, even if it came from the wrong man. And in doing so, it may have condemned more than a suspect. It may have condemned the truth itself. The arrest of Frank Dolezal. In August 1939, almost a year after the Kingsbury Run shantytowns were burned and no progress had been made in solving the case, police turned their attention to Frank Dolezal. Dolezal was a 52-year-old laborer from Hungary, with a quiet demeanor, poor English, and no legal representation. He had worked odd jobs across the city and, crucially, had once rented a room in the same boarding house as Florence Polillo, one of the few victims who had been identified. To detectives grasping at straws, that was enough. Dolezal was arrested and interrogated for hours, days, alone, without a lawyer. Eventually, exhausted and terrified, he confessed. Sort of. The confession, inconsistent, impossible. The statement Dolezal gave was incoherent, riddled with contradictions. He claimed he had fought with Florence Polillo over money. He claimed he had struck her, then blacked out. He claimed he woke up to find her dead and panicked. But he couldn't explain how her body had been dismembered with surgical precision, or why her head was never found, or how he'd disposed of her remains in multiple canvas bags placed miles apart. And most damning of all, when shown photographs of other victims, Dolezal claimed to recognize them as friends he had never actually met. The confession began to fall apart almost immediately, but by then it was already front page news. In custody, a death in the cell. Dolezal remained in jail for weeks. He was frail, confused, and bruised. When questioned by a new attorney, he recanted his confession and insisted he had been beaten and coerced. Then, on August 24, 1939, Frank Dolezal was found dead in his cell. The official ruling? Suicide by hanging. But the coroner's report told a different story. Dolezal's ribs were broken. His neck showed inconsistent trauma. There were signs of blunt force injuries to the head and abdomen. The autopsy cast doubt on the entire investigation. And just like that, the only man ever arrested for the Torso murders was gone. The fallout, a city embarrassed. In the weeks following Dolezal's death, public opinion turned sharply against the authorities. Editorials questioned the ethics of the interrogation. Civil rights groups decried police brutality. And legal scholars called for a federal investigation. But it never came. Instead, the case quietly collapsed. The confession was withdrawn. The files were archived. And the killer, whoever he was, remained nameless. Other false confessions. A pattern of desperation. Dolezal wasn't the only false lead. Over the years, multiple individuals confessed to the Torso murders. Some mentally ill, some seeking attention, some coerced under harsh questioning. one man confessed to 10 of the murders, while already serving time in another state during the killings. Another claimed to be possessed by the devil and recited graphic descriptions of bodies he had never seen, details easily found in the newspapers. None of these confessions held up, but in every case, the motivation was clear. Closure. The city needed to believe the nightmare had an ending, even if it meant inventing one. Theme. The systems need to conclude, even if it condemns. When institutions fail to solve a mystery, they often try to contain it instead. A confession, no matter how flawed, provides the illusion of control. It gives the public something to point to. It gives officials something to close. But in the case of the Cleveland Torso murders, the cost of that illusion was steep. A man may have died for a crime he didn't commit. A killer was emboldened by the system's blindness, and the investigation lost credibility it could never regain. Chapter 8, Cultural Ghosts. How the Torso Murders Shaped American True Crime. The Cleveland Torso Murders didn't end with a trial. There was no courtroom drama, no confession, no resolution. But in the absence of answers, something else took hold. A myth, the image of a faceless killer operating in the shadows of a broken city, cutting through the forgotten with surgical calm. It haunted not only Cleveland, but the national imagination. And in the decades that followed, the Torso Murders would transcend their own tragedy and begin shaping a genre. This chapter is about legacy, not of a man, but of a mystery, and how Cleveland's silence helped write the blueprint for American true crime. The birth of the American serial killer archetype. Before Bundy, before Dahmer, before Zodiac, there was the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. He had no face, no clear motive, no demands. He targeted the forgotten, killed without pattern, and left bodies as statements, not just crimes. Criminologists now view the Cleveland case as one of the earliest examples of what we now call a signature serial killer. The Torso Killer didn't just murder. He dismembered, posed, preserved, communicated. It was performance, ritualized and calculated, years before FBI profilers had a language for it. The killer shaped the psychology of fear, and in doing so, shaped how America would learn to fear killers. The influence on popular culture, from page to screen. The story of the Torso Murders refused to stay in the files of Cleveland detectives. In 1998, comic book author Brian Michael Bendis and illustrator Mark Andreyko released a graphic novel titled simply, Torso. It followed Elliot Ness in his later years as he tried to solve the case, tortured, obsessed, and ultimately broken by failure. The novel was praised for its gritty noir tone and factual depth. Critics called it true crime as visual poetry. It caught the eye of Hollywood, and soon, directors like David Fincher and Paul Greengrass were attached to adapt it to film. The movie remains unmade, but the screenplay continues to circulate, further embedding the killer into the cultural bloodstream. The story also appeared in court TV specials, unsolved mysteries, dozens of true crime podcasts and YouTube documentaries, as a case study in criminology textbooks and forensics training programs. Even the Netflix series Mindhunter, based on real FBI profiling, includes references to the butcher's psychological complexity. In this way, the case never really ended. It simply migrated into myth. How the media recast Ness, the flawed savior. In the years following his death, Elliot Ness's image underwent a transformation. Once immortalized as the man who brought down Al Capone, Ness began to appear in a new light. Not as the triumphant crime fighter, but as the tragic anti-hero. In popular retellings, Ness is shown, haunted by failure, consumed by his inability to stop the murders, destroyed, not by bullets, but by the weight of what he couldn't solve. This reframing didn't weaken his legend. It deepened it. It made him human. It turned the Cleveland Torso case into something more than history. It became a story of psychological unraveling. The victims in culture, still invisible. While the killer was immortalized, the victims remained mostly invisible. Their names, if known, faded from headlines. Their lives were reduced to footnotes beneath autopsy diagrams. Few movies or books remember Florence Polillo, Edward Andrassy, or the tattooed man. In many ways, this mirrors their treatment in life. They were never the focal point, not to the system, not to the city, not even, it seems, to the genre they helped create. And in that way, their erasure became part of the cultural pattern. We remember the killer. We forget the killed. Theme, a story retold but never reconciled. The Cleveland Torso murders didn't just leave bodies in their wake. They left echoes. Echoes in police thrillers, in horror films, in forensics classrooms. Echoes in how cities respond to fear. In how media packages terror. In how justice, when incomplete, becomes profitable narrative. But at the center of all that noise, one truth remains. We never caught the killer. We never gave names to the dead. And we never answered for why it happened in the first place. Chapter 9. DNA, exhumations, and the search for justice. For decades, the Cleveland Torso murders stood frozen in time. An open wound too cold to close, too complicated to stitch shut. But time has a way of changing the rules. Technology that once seemed like science fiction now reaches into the past with surgical precision. And in a modest lab, beneath cold fluorescent lights, fragments of bone, tooth enamel, and degraded tissue whisper to machines with names like Forensic, GEDmatch, and YSDR Profiler. In the 21st century, the victims of the Butcher of Kingsbury Run may finally be able to speak. And their message begins not with a headline, but with a genome. Modern forensics. Enter the DNA Doe Project. In 2024, nearly 90 years after the last known torso victim was found, the Cuyahoga County Medical Examiner's Office announced a breakthrough partnership. They were teaming up with the DNA Doe Project, a nonprofit dedicated to identifying John and Jane Does using genetic genealogy. Their method? Take degraded DNA samples from unidentified remains. Upload them to open-source genealogy databases. Cross-reference against distant relatives, sometimes third or fourth cousins, and reverse engineer a family tree that leads back to a name. It's slow. It's expensive. But it works. And in this case, it's the first true hope the victims have had in nearly a century. Exhumations, digging through history. In the spring of 2024, under strict forensic protocol, several graves were exhumed from Cleveland's municipal cemetery. These weren't marked with names, just numbers or simple codes like victim 1936, A. The bodies had been buried quickly, often in cheap wooden boxes. Decay was advanced. Samples were fragile. But science doesn't need perfection. It only needs enough. Bone fragments from Florence Polillo, the tattooed man, and two unidentified males were extracted and preserved for testing. And for the first time in generations, the dead were no longer silent. They were evidence. The process from bone to biography. Once extracted, the DNA was sequenced and compared against publicly available genealogy databases like FamilyTree DNA and GEDmatch Pro. Volunteers at the DNA Doe Project began the grueling task of mapping genetic connections, searching for anyone whose blood might connect back. Distant cousins, family branches, historical records. In some cases, the data led nowhere. Too degraded, too contaminated, too disconnected. But in others, clues emerged. A shared surname in Pittsburgh. A distant match in Toledo. A lineage connected to a missing person report from 1937. Slowly, painstakingly, the tree began to grow. A victim named, partial identification. In late 2024, one of the victims previously known only as Doe 1936-2B was partially identified. Through triangulated genealogical analysis, the individual was linked to a Slovak-American family who had lived in a Cleveland tenement in the 1930s. The man's name is being withheld pending further confirmation, but historians believe he may have been a steelworker laid off during the Depression, a man who vanished sometime between 1935 and 1936. His family never filed a police report. Why? Because they assumed he had left town. Because in that era, poor men disappeared all the time. But now, nearly 90 years later, a name is being stitched back to a body. It's not full justice, but it's something. Why identification still matters? You might ask, what does naming the victims do? The killer is long dead. No one will be tried. The system that failed them is gone. But naming is power. Naming restores dignity. Naming rewrites records. Naming tells families, descendants, survivors, even strangers, that these people mattered. They were not just victims of the torso killer. They were human. They had stories. And those stories did not end in a ditch beside a rail line. Theme: DNA as modern memory. The Cleveland torso murders may never be solved. But with every swab, every match, every family tree traced backwards through time, the mystery loses a little more of its grip. Because in this new century, DNA has become memory. A and memory is a form of resistance. Resistance against erasure. Resistance against silence. Resistance against the violence of being forgotten. Chapter 10, Legacy in Blood, Remembering the Forgotten. The case was never solved. There were no courtroom sketches. No final gavel strike. No dramatic confession or killer's remorse. Only the silence of graves with no names. And a city that moved on because it had to. But stories like this don't end just because the trail runs cold. They linger. In headlines. In textbooks. In the nervous systems of cities that never fully recovered. And in the case of the Cleveland Torso murders. They live on as a legacy carved not into justice, but into absence. Reflection, a city transformed by fear. Between 1934 and 1938, Cleveland was transformed. What began as a struggling industrial powerhouse in the grip of the Great Depression became a city haunted by the anatomy of evil. 12 confirmed victims, possibly more than 20, dismembered, decapitated, mutilated with surgical precision. Each body told a story, and each story ended the same way, unresolved. The fear didn't just live in Kingsbury Run. It seeped into boardrooms, classrooms, and bedrooms. It changed how the city saw itself. It changed how America understood crime. The cost of invisibility. Perhaps the most horrifying truth isn't how they died, but why they were chosen. The torso killer didn't target the powerful. He didn't attack the elite. He selected the invisible. People whose disappearances wouldn't make the evening papers. People already on the edge of existence. He weaponized poverty, addiction, displacement. He knew the system wouldn't search for those it never saw. And in that sense, Cleveland wasn't just the scene of the crime. It was an accomplice. Legacy of Elliot Ness, the burden of failure. For Elliot Ness, the torso case was a ghost he could never exorcise. He wrote books, gave speeches, but he never again wore a badge. He died in 1957, broke, in a small apartment, still trying to sell the story of his life. But in every draft, every interview, one chapter remained unwritten. He never spoke publicly about the man he believed was the killer, never confirmed the postcards, never defended the burning of Kingsbury Run, never apologized to the families still waiting for closure. In his silence, a second mystery was born. What did Elliot Ness know that he took to his grave? Culture, memory, and the shadows we carry. The Cleveland Torso murders remain one of the most brutal and unsolved serial killing cases in American history. But they also represent something larger. They show us how violence survives through forgetting, how justice collapses when systems fail the marginalized, how killers are remembered and victims erased. They've become a symbol, not just of a city's failure, but of a country's. Because the story of Cleveland isn't unique. It's repeated in every place where poverty meets silence, where violence targets the voiceless, and where justice is only afforded to the visible. Theme, remembrance as resistance. So what do we do with a story like this? We remember, not the headlines, not the killer, but the people. Florence Polillo, Edward Andrassy, the tattooed man, the boy, the lady of the lake, the ones without names, the ones still waiting for DNA to carry their truth forward, the ones who were lost because we let them go unnoticed. We remember them not because they were perfect, but because they were human, and being human is reason enough. Closing, faint echo of train on tracks. The tracks still run through Kingsbury Run. The city still breathes. The river still carries stories it will never tell. But every so often, a lab technician matches DNA. A journalist finds an old file. A family member uncovers a photo long buried in a drawer. And in that moment, the silence breaks. The story lives again. And the forgotten are finally remembered.